From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Conservative activists have been circulating petitions hoping to revoke Governor Whitmer's emergency powers. Today, Michigan's attorney general announced an investigation. We'll talk to a legal expert who filed a complaint.
I was absolutely shocked to hear of the methodologies, processes, and procedures that they were using to train petition gatherers.
Also, Governor Whitmer and legislative leaders make extra nice to get the state's spending plan done.
In many respects, this is something of a kumbaya budget.
And we'll speak with an urban planner who has a new manifesto for Detroit and elsewhere as a counter to gentrification.
I'm seeing a theme here in the kinds of places I like. They allow for a multitude of experiences to happen in the same place.
Lauren Hood's Afro-Urbanist Manifesto. Plus, we've got a beginner's guide to foraging Michigan mushrooms. Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what Detroit might look like with space preserved for the Black lives that have formed the fabric of the city.
When you don't speak to the culture that is unique to a place, you get something that's very Anytown USA. And why would you want to live in a place that's like every other place you've ever been to?
That's coming up later in the program. But first, Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel says she's opening a criminal investigation into the group Unlock Michigan. Formed to challenge Governor Whitmer's orders during the COVID pandemic, Unlock Michigan has been gathering signatures aimed at revoking the governor's emergency executive powers. A series of articles in the Detroit Free Press has reported over the summer that some of Unlock Michigan's signature gatherers were instructed to follow irregular and, in some cases, illegal procedures. Nessel says her office heard from Michiganders who were asked to sign, but she also heard from our first guest today, John Peerich. He's a retired attorney who works on the laws governing petition campaigns, and he has worked on various Republican causes in the past. John Peerich, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Good to be here.
When did you become suspicious about methods that Unlock Michigan was using?
Well, let me put a little preface on your introduction. Number one, I have represented Republicans, Democrats, and Independents in all election matters going back over 45 years. So I want to make sure that premise is clearly understood. I'm not acting as a partisan in this.
Certainly.
Number two, when did I become concerned? When I started reading media reports with regard to some of the activities that supposedly were occurring, and when I heard about and then obtained a copy of the video with the one trainer, I was absolutely shocked to hear of the methodologies, processes, and procedures that they were using to train petition gatherers, clearly in violation of the standards articulated in the Michigan election law for such a process.
And if I can just clarify a little bit further, had you done any investigation of Unlock Michigan's methods yourself, or was this strictly based on what you had read in the press?
I had done absolutely no investigation myself. You pointed out quite accurately that I'm retired from the active practice of law, but I have a lot of time to read newspapers and other accounts. And when I saw more and more of the evidence about the process and procedures that were being used, and then some of the statements of some of the people who were circulating on behalf of the effort, my suspicions were really aroused at that point.
Right. Now, the main article on this came from the Detroit Free Press. And the allegations against Unlock Michigan include telling signature collectors that it's really hard to get caught doing stuff. They didn't say stuff except for like forgeries, telling signature collectors it was okay to leave petitions unattended while they're collecting, telling signature collectors it's really easy to give misleading testimony about the collection process if they're deposed in court. Of all the things that the article mentions, what claims were of most concern to you?
Well, you've articulated the basic claims. Number one, to train people who go out into the field to circulate petitions in a fashion that clearly violates the standards articulated in the Michigan election law is absolutely wrong, number one. Number two, it's illegal. And number three, there should be consequences for that kind of conduct. Again, allowing petitions to sit around on a table and having people come up willy-nilly and sign them and not be witnessed by a circulator opens the entire process to an abuse that, you know, again, who knows who the people are who are signing it, number one. Number two, who knows how many times people sign multiple occasions using different names. And in my history of doing ballot petition checking and petition work over the number of years, I remember one particular case in the city of Detroit when then Mayor Dennis Archer was subject to a recall petition when circulators signed the names of the baseball rosters from the papers on a particular day. So you had all these names of professional athletes who were signing petition when in fact they weren't the real people doing it. Right. And that's what really aroused my suspicion about these methodologies and procedures that they were using.
What are some of the most common violations that you would typically see when you were still practicing? Was it the kind of forgeries that were kind of spectacular in the campaign you just mentioned?
I mentioned the one with then Mayor Archer. There was one woman who signed 147 times. We oftentimes see people who just sign any name that they want to sign when you're doing a review. The reality is there's another practice in this parlance known as round robining, where 10 people or 20 people would sit around a table and they'd have all these sheets in front of them and they just sign names and move them round the table, round the table, round the table. And when you're paying $3.50 a signature, what an incredible allure for someone who wants to be untoward to simply start signing petitions and get paid $3.50 for each one.
Did you have any strong feelings one way or the other about the content of the petition language or its intention to sort of reel in Governor Whitmer in how she's been exercising executive power during the pandemic? Did you have any feelings about that before you heard about the method of collection?
I absolutely had feelings about that. And I was interviewed numerous times throughout the last 6 months with regard to the governor's exercise of her authority under the 1945 Act. And I said over and over again, the legislature gave her this power authority just as they gave it to Governor Snyder or they gave it to Governor Blanchard or Governor Engler. And in fact, when there was an emergency, it was available to be used. In this particular case, I don't know what kind of emergency could be described any more accurately than one that kills over 6,000 people in our state and has infected, I don't even know the numbers today, 115,000, 120,000 of our residents. At great cost and great burden to our society, to our state, and to the economics and to the safety and health of our citizens.
The Free Press asked the originators at Unlock Michigan, you know, what they had to say about the irregularities that they reported. And the person who's the spokesman for Unlock Michigan, Fred Zolik, came back saying that Eric Tissinger, who featured prominently in the incidents that the Free Press was reporting about, that Eric Tissinger was someone who worked for this California-based signature collection company called In the Field, and that he, you know, Zolik was suggesting that Mr. Tissinger had been a plant and that the whole thing was a setup to try to make Unlock Michigan look bad. Do you have any thoughts on that contention and whether a setup of that kind would be possible to pull off in Michigan?
Well, number one, I have no idea who this individual is other than listening to his voice for over an hour, filled with profanity and filled with assertions that were absolutely mind-boggling with regard to what people can do. Number two, as I understand it, National Petition Management, a company based in Brighton and in Sacramento, California, is the lead company that's received somewhere close to $900,000 to circulate the petitions that supposedly was a volunteer effort. Mm. So if you've got a volunteer effort, why do you need nearly $1 million in funds to do this process? And I do know that National Petition Management that I've worked with and seen in the past, I do know that they subcontract to different petition gatherers. This is not an entity that has, you know, 500 employees around the state of Michigan. National Petition Management works primarily in California, and they subcontract to get people to go out and do the work, and then they're sort of a clearinghouse that brings in the petition sheets and collates them and counts them and then turns them in with their sponsor. So to say that they're unaffiliated is something I really don't have direct knowledge of other than what this individual said on the tape and what the transcript says.
Is it common for signature gathering subcontractors to work different sides of the aisle, so to speak, for them to sometimes gather signatures for Republican-supported ballot measures and sometimes for ones that were written by Democrats?
Most petition gathering firms that I'm familiar with and that I've worked with over the years work for anyone who will pay them, number one. Number two, when you're getting I mean, just imagine the cost. If you're paying someone $3.50 a signature, we're talking about some incredible sums of money, especially if you say, well, then again, I have no idea to know the total number of petition signatures that they purportedly are going to turn in. But if it is 500,000, if they collected 40% of those signatures, that's an incredible amount of money that's been spent on this process. So, you know, what they've actually done, how do they actually do it? It's always a mystery at each one of these because they're done differently. Some are focused mostly in Southeast Michigan and in larger communities where people gather at events. Some are focused in rural areas. Some with regard to, for instance, Right to Life, go to churches, go to different venues where they think they have a greater likelihood to get people to sign. Again, I don't know the process and procedure that was used in this case with regard to structure, but I do know I've read the information. I've seen the materials. I've seen photographs that were posted in different venues of unattended petitions, all of which is just absolutely improper.
Have you heard from any of the folks who were involved in Unlock Michigan yourself?
No, I don't think they're eager to talk to me at this point.
Tell me a little bit about the timetable that all this might go through. Could the petition process be delayed by an investigation?
Well, I don't even know if they've turned the petitions in yet. So if they have not turned the petitions in yet, there's certainly a possibility that could affect that process. I would have no way of knowing that, number one. Number two, if they do turn the petitions in, the petitions become the property of the Department of State as a repository of the filing under Article 2, Section 9 of the Michigan Constitution. So the petitions would then be in their hands. But again, I don't know where all the petitions would be at that point and whether or not they have called certain petitions out from certain circulators, certain areas of the state. I would have no idea. And I don't have the authority or the investigative clout to be able to find that out. But it would be very, very interesting to know that.
John Peerich is a retired attorney who has worked on several different petition gathering campaigns and other legal matters in Michigan. Mr. Peerich, thanks so much for your time.
Great talk to you, April. Have a great day.
In a few minutes, the magic and sometimes the menace of fall mushrooms.
You really need to know. You need to completely immerse yourself into the information before you head out there and just start picking anything you find.
A man who knows his fungus has some tips for us in just a minute. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. With all of the things happening these past couple of weeks, the state budget was passed with little fanfare, little to no public debate. And it appears that that's the way Governor Whitmer and Republican leaders in the legislature intended, something quiet and uneventful. However, what is functional is not always the most transparent process. And sometimes budgets that get passed without a lot of scrutiny can be costly. Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for Michigan's Public Radio Network, joins us now to talk more about what happened in Lansing while everyone else was occupied with other things. Rick, hi.
Hi, April.
So how fast was this budget written and produced compared with a normal year?
Well, it obviously went to close till the end, but once the deal was made, it happened very fast with no hearings, which I just can't recall in all my years of covering the Capitol, and with little to no debate, just to get it done under the wire.
When I heard that the budget was practically done, I thought, wait a minute, wasn't this the same Governor Whitmer who was duking it out with Republican leaders in the legislature last year over roads and other issues to the brink of a shutdown? I mean, was there some kind of outbreak of peace, love, and understanding?
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but it was dramatically different from last year when we saw that standoff. But there was just much less to work with this year, and when there's much less to work with, then sometimes that leads to understandings that might not exist in other times, and that seemed to be the case this year. That we had a lot of emergencies, COVID primary among them, and it just needed to get done.
What do we know about what is and is not in the budget? I mean, I know that some big lifts were made to preserve funding for schools and cities. I mean, do we still have a Department of Natural Resources in the state of Michigan?
Yes, we do. And you know, we have a lot of those things. It's essentially a continuation budget, including schools, some assistance to deal with COVID emergency, with the COVID emergency, of course, and a plan to kind of just let schools figure it out and see how it goes. And that was probably the centerpiece of the budget deal. And, right now the governor is, and her team are fly-specking it, and we'll see if there are line item vetoes or anything like that. But yeah, in many respects, this is something of a kumbaya budget.
Do you think that there might be long-term consequences of going through this process so fast? I mean, are you hearing from some legislators of either party who are like, wait a minute, what just happened?
There are a handful of legislators who've complained about the process and what we're seeing coming out of this. And of course, there will be consequences. There are always consequences that, whether they want it to be or not, this budget is going to serve as the baseline for the next budget. That's just the way that budgets work, that they're not going to go and take last year's budget and say that, this is what we're working from. And so, I mean, in that respect, there will be consequences. There will also be consequences because, as we've learned in 2020, we don't know what's around the corner. We don't know what's coming next. And so, we're really kind of lurching from crisis to crisis right now, and we don't know when that is going to end.
Right. The biggest cut that we have been aware of to this point seems to be the elimination of the Detroit Reentry Center from within the Department of Corrections budget. Were there any other major cuts that you heard about or that you think maybe might have sort of slipped under public notice in this process?
That's entirely possible, but if that's the case, include me as part of the problem. Mm. The Detroit Reentry Center was probably the most controversial one, and there were a few Detroit lawmakers who, got up and, raised a hullabaloo about that because, in Detroit and other places, you don't really want a corrections facility in your backyard. In Detroit, that's jobs, and in some cases, it's also a support system for people who are hoping to succeed once they are released from the physical custody of the correction system.
Can I just ask you a question on another measure, Rick? The state legislature just approved a measure that would give Michigan's clerks more time to count ballots before the general election. Can you just recap for us how much time clerks have now and whether the clerks are saying that this is going to be enough to deal with the glut of absentee ballots this year?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, it's not more time to count ballots. It's more time. I wouldn't even say it's more time to process ballots. It's more time to pre-process absentee ballots, that they're allowed to basically open the envelopes. So when the time comes to take the ballots out of their security envelopes and run them through the counting machines, that's just one less step, which will hopefully speed up the process a little, that many election clerks and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson were hoping for more in terms of finding ways to speed up counting ballots. But that was as far as the Republican leadership in the legislature was willing to go.
Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much for the updates.
Always a pleasure, April.
Beyond morels, there are a good deal of wild mushrooms growing all across Michigan. And fall's a great time of year to find them and enjoy them. But you really should be careful. Here to talk us through what to look for when you're out foraging for wild mushrooms and how you might prepare them once you've verified is Zach Schrader. He's Director of Culinary Arts for Lake Superior State University and the director of Le Chenot Culinary School. That's a farm-to-table operation in Hessel on the Upper Peninsula. Zach Schrader, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
So what is your favorite mushroom this time of year?
There's a lot. It's really hard to choose from. I like a variety. But, chanterelles are always top of my list, no matter what time of year it is. And right now is a good time to find them. And so we love to use the chanterelles.
Can't go wrong with the classics. Well, yeah. Tell us about ideal weather conditions and habitat for Michigan's wild mushrooms.
Yeah, and so well, a lot of wild mushrooms can probably be found in any forest, really, in Michigan. The best criteria is generally old growth forests. You want to have trees that have some age to them, as well as a lot of moisture. You want to have a lot of rain. And luckily in the fall in Michigan, we get a lot of rain, that's for sure.
Yeah. It feels like just in our part of Southeast, things have been a little bit dry. Are you notice anything overall about what conditions would be like for mushrooms at this point in the fall?
Well, I'm up here in the UP, and it seems over the last 2 weeks, we've had a lot of rain.
Well, good.
Yeah, in fact, it's raining right now. And so we've had plenty of rain. But yeah, you're not going to find a lot of mushrooms if you don't get a lot of rain.
Well, let's talk about a few varieties that people might want to look for that they hadn't heard of before. There was one that I recently learned about that I had never heard of, but it's just got the most amazing name. It is the chicken of the wood. What does it look like and how would we know it if we saw it?
Well, chicken of the woods, it's really easy to find compared to a lot of your other wild mushrooms. It's bright orange on the cap, and then it has like little yellowish orange tips to the end of the mushrooms. They generally grow on dead or dying oak trees. And so if you're in an oak, older growth oak forest, they stand out. They're like hunter's orange. So you can't miss them when you're walking through the woods, which is really like a different, unique kind of thing compared to most other mushrooms. You have to have an eye for detail when you're finding them in the woods. With chicken of the woods, they kind of like throw themselves at you.
Well, I always appreciate something that makes it simpler. What can you make with chicken of the woods?
Well, with chicken of the woods, one problem that they do have is some specimens are not as good as the other ones. And so if you find just the right one, you'll notice it'll feel like springy, almost like the texture of meat. Like when you pinch it, it should be spring back and rather than be like rock hard or turn into mush. And so if you find one that has like kind of that, like you could almost feel the moisture in it, how it's rubbery feeling rather than chalky feeling. And so you want to have that like rubbery feel on chicken of the woods in particular, or else, because if it's been on the tree too long and it's been too dry out, it'll get chalky. And nobody wants like a chalk like texture in their mouth.
Got it.
I usually cut like the first 3 inches off the end of the caps. And then I leave the middle kind of for other purposes, which we do a lot of like making broth and things like that, where you're not actually eating the texture of the mushroom. You're just getting the flavor. But that outside part, really, you can use it any way you'd like. We like to kind of sear them and use them in stir fries, or we would make soup with them, various types of applications. Really anything that you could do with chicken, I'm assuming you could probably do with chicken of the woods.
So chanterelles, I mean, obviously this is sort of the holy grail for mushroom hunters in a lot of ways. These are more popular. And I mean, they can be found in the grocery store. Is it worth really trying to go out and get them wild?
Well, it's kind of like morels with chanterelles in the fact that everybody has their secret spot. And it seems to be that they grow in particular areas a lot more prevalently than just kind of scattered throughout the woods. And so if you happen upon a chanterelle spot, it should produce for years and years and years. And so my thought is take a walk in the woods. And if you end up finding them, then you can rely on them. But I wouldn't rely on just walking out in the woods somewhere and ending up on a bumper crop of chanterelles.
I read about one called, I think it's called a hericium, that I hadn't heard of before. Can you tell me more about this kind?
Sure. Well, there's three different types of hericiums, which I kind of just lump them all together in my head, and they all look very similar. They're also known as coral mushrooms or bear's tooth or lion's mane. There's a few different names, but they're stark white and they look like coral, and they generally grow off beech trees, dead or dying beech trees. And they are delicious. And what's nice about them is they're large and white, and semi easy to find, not as easy as the chicken of the woods. And when you get some, they're usually in 2 or 3 pound clusters, or 1 to 3 pound clusters, we'll say. And you break those apart, and we like to saute them with any kind of vegetables we want, or you can even bread them and deep fry them. They're delicious that way as well.
I heard you've been doing some good things with something called a honey mushroom. How would I know that if I saw it?
Well, honey mushrooms, also known as stumpers. We call them stumpers or stumpies up here. What's nice about them is they're really easy to find. Come like middle of September and you get a lot of rain, they'll grow in clusters, usually around like a fresh, like logged area, maybe an area that was logged by a logging company within the last 3 to 5 years.
And you'll see these mushrooms growing in clusters. And that's the important part about them is it's multiple stems that go down into one kind of base. And if you find them before the cap opens up too much, they'll be delicious and uniform. What happens is when the cap gets too large and you'll see the cap kind of like splay out, that allows insects in. And so you'll have insects that have kind of like tunneled through the cap of your mushroom and things like that, which makes them less prime than they would be before that cap opens up. But really, you can treat those like a button mushroom that you buy in the grocery store. You can saute them, you can pickle them, you can poach them, you can use them in stocks and sauces and things like that. And really, the sky's the limit. And you could go out in the fall and easily harvest 20 or 30 pounds in one day.
Hey, Zach, how long have you been foraging for mushrooms?
I've been foraging mushrooms, really the main ones, like the chanterelles and the morels and things like that, ever since I was a little kid. In fact, some of my earliest memories were walking around in the woods with my mom, trying to find morels. And she used to take a glass morel that she bought at a trade show or something like that, or an art show. And she'd hide it in the backyard and send my sister and me out there to find it as like a competition. So I was involved in morel picking from as early as I can remember.
Yeah, I guess you got to start them young, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, how do you know? I mean, the thing that's always kind of held me back is I've always been a little freaked out that I would pick the wrong one and poison myself. How do you know when you're ready to get out there and really choose mushrooms in a way that's safe and it's not going to put yourself or anybody you're cooking for at risk?
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, you really need to know. You need to completely immerse yourself into the information before you head out there and just start picking anything you find. And the resource that I use is MidwestMycology.org. They usually do a wild mushroom certification course. I think that's kind of on hold with the COVID-19 thing going on here. But they have individual study guides for each mushroom. I study those. And then when I'm in the field, it's natural for a person to try to convince themselves, especially if you spent the entire day not finding mushrooms, that a mushroom is edible. And you should really have it the opposite, where you can't convince yourself otherwise that it's not edible. And so you should spend a good amount of time looking at that specimen, comparing your notes before ever dabbling in taking any guesses. And another, really the best way is to find somebody that you know, or that you know through people that knows the woods and the mushrooms well, and ask them if they'll take you out once or twice. I think that's the safest way.
Do you have any other tips for folks who are maybe a little new at this? I mean, good mushroom hunters do not give up their best spots very easily. How does one get started in knowing where to go?
Another great research apparatus from MidwestMycology.org is that it supplies the information you need for finding the mushrooms as well. And some of those things are the type of tree that the mushroom is associated with. All mushrooms generally have some either type or types of trees that they're directly associated with. Soil type also plays in that too. For example, chanterelles up here grow in sandy soil. And so, you know, if you're in a sandy soil area, that's likely to find them. Also, I mean, the biggest thing is getting your boots on the ground and head out in the woods. And the first few times that you pick, you might not find anything, but eventually you're going to run into some mushrooms. And then I like to then save them. I keep a GPS log of all the mushrooms that I find so that in future years I can go right back to that same spot that I found them in the past and go from there. And really, it's just about the amount of time put in.
As I mentioned, you're coming to us from Les Chenaux Culinary School, which is in Hessel, which is in the Upper Peninsula. It's not really far from the bridge and Mackinac Island. Will you tell us a little bit about the school and what you're doing up there right now?
Sure. We are a one-year culinary certificate program. We're part of Lake Superior State University. And so if you go to their website, you can find more information about us. But we're very small. One thing we pride ourselves on is the tight-knit family that our students kind of develop over the year. We started in September, we end in September. So that's another thing that we've done is we've made it a one-year program, where most of your general culinary schools are 2 years. And we really wanted to get the students in. The hospitality industry is itching for employees right now. And so we're trying to make sure that we get as many students into the workforce and well-trained as possible.
Zach Schrader is Director of Culinary Arts at Lake Superior State University and also runs Le Chenot Culinary School in Hessel. Zach, thanks so much for talking to us.
Hey, thank you.
Devotees of Michigan's other varieties of fungus are chalking up a win now that the city of Ann Arbor has effectively decriminalized psychedelic plants and fungi. City Council has declared that use of magic mushrooms is a lowest law enforcement priority. And the resolution further notes such plants, and I'm quoting here, can benefit psychological and physical wellness, support and enhance religious and spiritual practices, and can reestablish humans' inalienable and direct relationship to nature, end quote. While Ann Arbor is not the first city in the United States to make this move, it might be among the most predictable. Up next, we talk about preserving Black spaces in Detroit.
To me, it seems so elementary. Like, how do you not center the Black experience when you're in a neighborhood that's mostly Black? But it's something that we take for granted.
Planning strategist Lauren Hood has a new manifesto for Afro-urbanism. We'll talk to her in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You may have had an opportunity these past few months to see the place where you live through new and different eyes. If you live in Detroit, or even if you don't, maybe you've just been taking in your surroundings, the less populated spaces, with new ways and maybe a new clarity. Lauren Hood is a strategist and consultant based in Detroit whose field is equitable development. Her work is to see the architecture of our cities, some of it visible, some of it invisible, that shapes how we interact and how we go through our lives. She's a native of Detroit's Bagley neighborhood, and she recently published an essay that got a lot of attention talking about the fabric of our cities as they might be seen through a concept she calls Afro-urbanism. Lauren Hood, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Will you tell us, first of all, just share with us a little bit about some of your favorite places in Detroit?
Ooh, tricky. I think the riverfront is one of my favorite places, mostly because it doesn't feel like it belongs to any one group of people. You know, you see old people there, young people there, people that look affluent, people that don't. Every different cultural group is represented. It kind of doesn't belong to anybody, so it belongs to everybody.
Right.
That's one of my favorite, like, outdoor spaces. In terms of indoor spaces, I was thinking the other day about how much I love and miss St. Andrew's Hall. Like, I'm a live music fan, and it's killing me that I can't go see a show right now.
I know. In your essay, your call for Afro-urbanism, you point out that one of the problems in modern planning is that we center the built environment. Living our lives believing that the value is the property, not the people. How do the riverfront or St. Andrews, how do you see those places allowing for a recalculation of value?
Well, I think it seeks to meet the needs, the aspirations, the desires of the people. So when you go to the riverfront, you're not really looking at the infrastructure. When I'm walking down there, all I see is people, you know? I'm looking at what they're doing, how they're communicating with each other, their expressions. It's just the place prioritizes the people. I'd say, interestingly, same thing with St. Andrews. It's all about the event. It's not about the building, because that building's been grimy for a long time. But it's so much more about, like, the authentic kind of programming that happens there. What I love about it is that it runs the gamut of experiences. St. Andrews has, it'll have, like, the super hoodest hip-hop show one night and have the most, like, ethereal, alternative British pop music the next night. I guess, yeah, I'm seeing a theme here in the kinds of places I like. They allow for a multitude of experiences to happen in the same place.
Not to mention, we have to show some love for any venue that's going to take on local pro wrestling.
Oh, did they do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, tell us.
Nice.
Tell us about what Afro-urbanism is and what is its promise.
Well, being able to expressly say that we're centering the lived experience, the culture, and the aspirations of Black folks. You know, lots of cities across the country with majority Black populations or previously majority Black populations are in this period of rapid change. And it's not uncommon that the consultant teams that are doing the strategic plans for neighborhoods, that are working on development projects in these neighborhoods, are mostly white. You know, there's a special kind of way that Black folks communicate. There's certain things we value that other cultures don't. And there's just a kind of awareness that you have to have if you really want to build relationships and do things that have a transformative impact for people. And you can't do it if you don't understand the culture. So this says, no, we're centering Black voices, Black culture, Black experience in the recreation of this Black neighborhood. And it, to me, it seems so elementary. Like, how do you not center the Black experience when you're in a neighborhood that's mostly Black? But it's something that we take for granted. And I think it's a moment in a post-Floyd world where we can say Black and center Black and everybody's okay with it. Because mm-hmm. that has not always been the case.
Right. When we talk about development in predominantly Black and brown neighborhoods, there is so much experience of gentrification and displacement. You know, again, putting the built environment over people in the planning and development of a space. Can you talk about a space where you've seen that happen and what it looks like? You know, what is maybe lost in those spaces?
Well, you end up getting development that's generic. So you could take a snapshot of a commercial corridor in Austin, San Francisco, Brooklyn, and all the new restaurants and all the public spaces have a similar vibe, you know, a similar aesthetic. You could guarantee that it's got a certain kind of font in the logo, that they've got a certain kind of lighting, that there's some reclaimed wood in the space. When you don't speak to the culture that is unique to a place, you get something that's very Anytown USA. And why would you want to live in a place that's like every other place you've ever been to? So I think this attention to the unique culture that each place has, it allows for a more authentic experience. It should be attractive to people that it's different. This generic kind of programming that we do, I don't understand who's attracted to that. Why would you want to go to a place that's like the place that you're getting away from? We have to do what we can to identify and amplify the rich culture that is already in these places. And that only happens through a certain kind of conversation. You have to have a certain kind of mindset. That's why I labeled it Afro-urbanism, because Black folks are already kind of doing this work in our communities. But for other folks that aren't part of that culture that are doing work in that communities, if you can put the Afro on there, then they know that they have to do something different. They know that they have to have a different kind of conversation, and they know that they have to have people at the table that are traditionally left out.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? This is something that you addressed in the article. How are residents taking on the work of urban planning for the spaces where they live?
Well, it's interesting. There are urban planners in neighborhoods that, you know, wouldn't even call themselves that. There's like the block club president. There's the guy who just created a community garden because he knew people in his neighborhood needed to eat better and he wanted to do something about it. It's happening all over the city. It just doesn't get talked about. And it's a matter of having those relationships to even know that that's going on.
We're coming out of a decade when transformational development has been happening in Detroit. However, you know, as you and many, many others have noted, that development has very often sidelined the Black life that is the life of Detroit. Now, we're in this period since March where everything economically has changed pretty drastically. And I wanted to ask you what you think is going to happen to the spaces in Detroit that have changed and gentrified?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Like, should we assume that things after the pandemic, that things will continue on the track that they were on?
Well, they can't. I feel like this, the first pandemic, not the racial one, the COVID pandemic, kind of revealed and to the world, our shortcomings here, and we can't move forward in the same way. You know, the disparities in lived experience, health outcomes, wealth, employment along racial lines was kind of made clear during COVID when we were in the international media for how many lives we lost and how disproportionately those lives were Black. You know, it's going to be the result of shame, but whatever it takes to kind of get us to pivot and do things differently. This can't be, you know, a trend kind of moment where we react to what's going on right now and don't change things for the long term. We have to transform, and it requires a different approach to how we do this work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is strategist and consultant Lauren Hood. She recently published an essay in the journal Public Square called The Case for Afro-Urbanism. Lauren, the principles that you laid out that guide Afro-Urbanism include this one: the community is the client, no matter who is footing the bill. One of the unspoken truths of market-driven development is that developers and builders tend to build for the most affluent users in the market. You know, that they'll build for as expensive a concept as the market will support. Now, most of us, because of that, sort of end up living and working in spaces that weren't really designed with us in mind. And that's clearly doubly true for Black and brown folks. So when you're at the table with developers and architects, how do you get them to accept the reality that the community is the client and that the spaces that they're working on will be used by those who were intended and those who maybe they didn't intend over time?
Well, a couple of ways. I like to ask lots of critical questions. It is not my method to tell people what they should be doing. It's to ask critical questions to get people to draw the conclusion on their own that they need to do it differently. And I'm always advocating that we have different kinds of people at the table. I have been on a number of projects where we're making decisions about, you know, infrastructure changes to a community, and nobody from the community is at the table, ever. My method is to advocate that those people are there so that they can advocate for themselves. That's the only way that we're going to end up with outcomes that actually serve people.
Do we have to rely on the goodwill of builders and developers to change the kinds of things you're talking about?
Hell no. It'll never work that way. You know, another line of the work I do is racial equity consulting. And, you know, I learned early on that you can't appeal to anyone's inner moral compass to make them change. You have to make the value proposition work for the person that you're dealing with. So in terms of a real estate developer, you've got to make the case for how it impacts the bottom line. You want to talk long-term sustainability. When you do a development that's, you know, it's on trend, you're doing something that you think serves the community you want to have, not the community that you do already have, those things are very short-lived. We can see that in Midtown. There was this super high-end leather goods store, and everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's amazing, what a beautiful space, look at all this. And they closed after like 4 years or something. And what they displaced to get that there was a grocery store. It was in a state of disrepair, but it actually served a population that now doesn't get served. You know, it was kind of an affordable grocery store. I know that the owner of that grocery store used to go around the neighborhood and pick people up and bring them to the store so that they could shop. So they moved that out of the way so that we could have this really high-end leather goods store. And now the store is closed because people weren't buying that in this community. So these are the kind of implications of not having good engagement.
We know that Detroit and Wayne County are, you know, haven't been in great shape for the past 6 months. And while there has been some federal money to backfill budgets and stuff, there is every anticipation that local governments really all over Michigan are really going to be strapped over at least the next year as the ripple effect of the pandemic and the ensuing economic shutdown hits us. I mean, what does this mean for people in a decision-making position who might be looking at permits and being asked to partner on developments? What are some best practices to make sure that what happens in Detroit over the next 5 years, over the next decade, really supports communities?
Well, I think people have to be comfortable with the unknown. I'm finding that in one of the planning processes I'm working on right now, we really haven't made space to address current issues. We're still talking about bringing new businesses online and activating storefronts that respond to a pre-pandemic demand. And that demand's just not there anymore. But whether it's for housing or retail, people are really income insecure. There are Black communities where we're still mourning and we're still grieving. We lost a lot of people. There just isn't a lot of will to engage. There's not a lot of consumer confidence. So I feel like if anything is to be sustainable, we have to adjust for the changes in demand that are because of these two pandemics that we're experiencing.
You mentioned the losses of this year in the pandemic. Do you think there's a way that design has a role to play in helping people mark this time or get through the grief?
Absolutely. I think there was a really powerful exhibit on Belle Isle that kind of had all the faces of the people that we had lost. Well, it was a significant number. I think they had 900 images up of people that we had lost.
As many as the organizers could get approval for with facial images of the people who had died.
Yeah. So if you can just imagine, like when you hear that number 900, you're like, okay, that's a lot of people. When you see the names and you see the faces. And on the day I drove through, there were families gathered around the picture of their loved one. It really drives home how far reaching the impact of those losses is. So it's not just those folks that are gone, like each of those people had a family and a network. So it really shows, you know, the broader impact of all of those losses. And I do think that, yeah, the built environment should serve us. Like, how can it address these two pandemics? How can we pay homage to the people that we've lost, but also how do we create spaces that allow us to come together in ways that we haven't before? That is the beauty of public spaces. They don't have to belong to any specific group. You can create a space that feels welcoming to everyone, but you need everyone at the table in determining how that's laid out.
Likewise, are there ways in which design can sort of move us toward things that we want for the future in addition to acknowledging the things in our past?
Well, I think I didn't get to make the connection between the restoration of spirit and how it impacts community outcomes. I think that when we're talking about community development, we really stick to the issues that are present and prevalent right now. And we don't lay out, you know, plans for that, for the future that people want to see. I can't tell you how many times people's response to the question, like, what do you want for your community, is around, oh, pick the trash up, or, you know, get my lights turned on. But that's all? Like, how do we set you up to have a community that fulfills your future hopes and dreams and aspirations? Tapping into people's imagination is a part of Afro-urbanism that I don't think we do in traditional urbanism. Traditional urbanism, like I said, just solves like present issues, but Afro-urbanism creates a space where we can tap into some imagination around building the dream communities of our future.
What does restorative design look like?
That's a good question. And you're going to have a different answer depending on what community that you're in. Talking to people about what has happened in their communities and who's responsible are questions that need to be answered when you're thinking about doing something that is restorative. It's going to be different for everybody.
Lauren Hood is a consultant and strategist based in Detroit. Her recent essay, The Case for Afro-Urbanism, can be found online at CNU's Public Square Journal. Lauren Hood, real pleasure talking with you. Thank you for taking a few minutes for us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.